Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. This summer marks the 50th anniversary of the release of Jaws. Not only are there local events associated with the anniversary, the increasing number of white sharks in waters off Cape Cod has created a lot of shark hype and misinformation. Later in the hour, we'll talk with Carmen Braun, assistant scientist and ocean ecologist at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, about some of the misconceptions about sharks and how a changing ocean will impact these predators. But first, we get an update about ongoing research into white shark behavior and biology with Greg Skomel, senior fisheries scientist with the Massachusetts Division of Marine Fisheries.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. Hey, before we talk science, let's talk movies. There's been a number of events around the 50th anniversary of the film Jaws. Do you remember when you first saw that film?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and I talk about it in my book quite extensively because it motivated me to be a shark biologist.
How old were you?
I was 13 years old, emerging from middle school and looking for a career. But I already had a fascination with the ocean and sharks in general. And then I saw Matt Hooper and decided that would be a really good job.
You know, many people say they stopped swimming in the ocean for a period of time after seeing the film. I was one of them. But as time passed and we can laugh a little at that mechanical shark, the film's become a cult classic of sorts. And you've gone to many of these Jaws-related events over the years. How has the film also been an opportunity to educate people about white sharks and their role in the ecosystem?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Mindy, when you say that, you know, at first, you know, public perception was certainly negative. The film tapped into that. It scared people. I still occasionally meet someone who says they won't go back in the water, but that effect has really diminished over time. And now people look at the movie Jaws and they think of sharks more with fascination, really, than fear. And that's great. It's wonderful to see that perception evolve and shift. And it's also led to great discoveries. You know, people now embrace sharks, or a lot of them do. Not everyone, of course. And it has led to a lot of great research. And many colleagues of mine who are also motivated by Jaws, you know, have produced great stuff that has led ultimately to sustainable management and conservation.
Yeah. So how long have you been tagging white sharks off the Cape and Islands?
Well, although my first tag went out in 2004, we really didn't ramp up until 2009. And so now that's like we've got 15 years under our belt, and we're starting up our 16th year here. And I'm pretty excited to get back out there. We just haven't been on the water yet.
Yeah. And talk a little bit about how the tagging technology has changed over time.
Well, back when the film came out, you know, really there were only a couple of tagging technologies. The simplest was just a conventional tag that you put on sharks when you released it. And then slowly acoustic telemetry has emerged as a new tool back in the 70s, was a new tool. But since then, you know, with the development of satellite linkages, smaller batteries, very sophisticated sensors and camera systems, you know, we've basically moved from a primitive car, you know, a Model T to a Corvette. And it's been amazing what those tools have produced in terms of what we learned about behavior and movement ecology and basic biology.
And so the tags that you're using now, how long do they stay on?
Well, the acoustic technology back in the 70s would last just a couple of days. Now those tags last up to 10 years. So my goal is to get those tags on white sharks and have them stay there for 10 years. That doesn't always happen. But to be able to get multiple years of data from a single tag for a single shark to look at changes over the life of the shark is really amazing, you know. And and some of the satellite link tags, you know, you keep those on generally for about a year because they can only hold so much data. And then the more sophisticated camera tag systems that record what the shark is doing every second, you know, those only last really for a couple of days. But I imagine over time that's going to increase.
So how many total tag sharks do you follow right now?
Well, we've put out tags on over 350, I think 380 individual white sharks since we started in 2009. But as the tag technologies have improved over years, some of those tags, you know, we initially put on are dead now. So we don't hear from those sharks. But we're definitely hearing from acoustic tags for well over, 150 of those sharks, probably closer to 200 still.
What kind of data are you getting from those tags?
Well, our questions, science, questions evolve over time. When we first started doing this, we were very much interested in the big scale movements of migrations of white sharks, as it relates to the conservation and the stock structure of the species, those kinds of fisheries and conservation questions. Obviously, on Cape Cod, as we saw, the number of negative incidents increase in recent years, meaning over the last decade or so, and really on a small scale, but still it had us starting to think on small scales. When do they arrive in Massachusetts? Where do they spend their time? When do they leave? And we've been using those technologies that answer those questions. And then we're very much interested in fine scale behavior in recent years. So we're using the camera tag systems to better understand, what motivates these sharks to feed close to shore, what precipitates that, what are the conditions that are prevailing when that happens. And the goal ultimately to be to try to produce information that will enhance public safety.
We're learning so much. So, what is the typical range for the white sharks in our waters?
Well, when we think of the white sharks in Massachusetts, some of us tend to think, oh, those are Cape Cod sharks, right? And or you know, and that's really not the case. We're really talking about a general broad scale Western North Atlantic population that ranges from really the Mexican border, because we had one of our sharks cross into Mexico, throughout the Gulf of Mexico, all along the eastern seaboard of the US, up into Canadian waters, as far as the Gulf of St. Lawrence and Newfoundland. So, and the distribution of the species also extends out to the Mid-Atlantic Ridge as far as the Azores. So we're talking about a broad scale migration that occurs with this species that basically expands and contracts seasonally, like many species of fish that visit Massachusetts.
So you talked about seeing when they arrive and when they leave. So what times of year are they moving from northern to southern waters and from southern to northern waters? And is this biannual migration driven by water temperature? Is it food? What is it?
Well, it's largely water temperature, but also the motivated by food as well. They make these broad migrations to get to some of the most productive waters in the Western North Atlantic, and that includes, the Gulf of Maine, Cape Cod, the Gulf of Maine, all the way up into Canada. So the timing is such that, the sharks are moving up from their southern areas. They start to move, generally in late March, April. We don't start seeing them until late April, early May, and they're just trickling in. A lot of people are saying, well, the sharks are around right now, Greg. It's late June. The truth is, we've had several pilots up in the air and they're not seeing, sharks at all. They don't begin to really ramp up until we get into July. And typically in recent years, late July. And then our peak months in Massachusetts are August, September, October. And many of these sharks will keep moving up into the Gulf of Maine and Canadian waters. And then as temperatures cool down, in early to mid-November, the sharks will begin moving out, leaving Cape Cod, leaving the Gulf of Maine, leaving Canada, and they're all virtually gone by mid-December.
Now, you're collaborating with the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy, and they've developed a Sharktivity app. Explain how the app uses data for the sharks you've tagged. There's these different color icons, right?
That's right. Yeah, the Sharktivity app, which is available for free from the Conservancy, is really an educational tool. It's to give folks, an appreciation of where these sharks occur. Some of the data streams are in real time, from some of our satellite link tags and from reports, credible reports that are vetted by the New England Aquarium and the Conservancy, and posted, but also some of our data sets that are not necessarily live, but are archived. So our acoustic data sets. So what we're trying to do is educate the public about the presence of these animals. We really don't want folks to use the Sharktivity app as a real-time tool. I don't want them to look at it and say, well, no sharks, white sharks have been reported off of, let's say, Chatham, today, so it must be all right to go swimming out in great distances. No, we want you to use it looking at the historical data as well as some of the live data to get a sense of where these sharks occur.
I think everyone would like to find a silver bullet to keep people safe from sharks in the water, but there just isn't, right? And it likely never will be. So your rule of thumb to keep in mind when swimming in the waters around the Cape and Islands, what do we need to think about?
Well, I want folks to go to the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy's website. We post a lot of our acoustic telemetry data there in the White Shark Logbook. And you get a sense of where white sharks occur off the coast of Massachusetts. They're not evenly distributed, right? So if you're in one of those areas where there's high densities, high abundance of white sharks, and that's primarily along the Outer Cape, the eastward-facing beaches of Massachusetts, then be cognizant of that. You know, that's not the case throughout Massachusetts. Be cognizant of the fact that white sharks do occur seasonally in high abundance, August, September, and October. They're feeding on seals for so look for the prevalence of seals in those locations, and be cautious when you swim. The probability of being bitten, and everybody's heard it, is extremely low, but it does happen. And so, you know, if you're concerned about your safety, don't go out too far. And I'll generally say in those high abundance areas, don't go in over your waist.
Yeah, and don't swim with the seals
Don't swim with the
ever.
seals.
All right, so what do you consider the most significant things that we've learned about white sharks since you first began your research? You know, things we didn't have a good understanding about before.
Well, I think one thing that emerged from the movie Jaws or Jaws tapped into was this fear of sharks and this mythical creature, this creature that, you know, the myth being that the creature was evolved to feed on people. And, you know, and that's certainly not the case. You know, our studies have revealed a fairly complex life cycle that extends over a very broad distribution. You know, when these sharks move into the offshore waters of the Atlantic, they dive to depths as great as 3,000 feet. We didn't know that. These sharks live in excess of 70 years. They're extremely slow growing, and they're very vulnerable to exploitation, much like m many species of marine mammals. So their population can be do knocked down very, very quickly if they're exploited. And they feed on a variety of species. You know, yes, we focus on the seals when they're close to shore, but they also move offshore and feed on a variety of fish species, including other sharks, and other species of fish. And they love to scavenge whales. And so the more we understand this species, the better, the more we study it, you know, the more we appreciate that its role in the ecosystem is important, and we need to keep the population of white sharks and other shark species at sustainable levels.
And of course, Jaws was based on the book by Peter Benchley. And we've read many interviews where Peter was really felt badly after what happened to great white sharks after the Jaws came out. But he really kind of turned to Shark Conservancy after, right? I mean, he really want I think he would be so happy to hear all we're learning about sharks and getting a better idea of you know, who they really are.
That's absolutely right. Before Peter died, I had a chance to meet him and to talk to him and see him present information that was clearly focused on conservation and sustainable management of sharks. And his wife, Wendy, who is still around, is really an icon in shark conservation now. And so, you know, I think it's wonderful. I think he was a little hard on himself. You know, it was really the development of broad-scale commercial fishing for sharks on a global scale, you know, that led to the demise of shark populations, and not necessarily the movie Jaws. But I appreciate what the steps Peter took, you know, after the film.
Yeah. So what are the key things you hope you all that we'll learn more about in the coming decade?
You know, we're really focused right now on fine scale behavior and better understanding how these animals are acting in our nearshore areas. So I'm hoping that, you know, we can draw some conclusions in the coming, you know, years regarding, you know, what areas might be more dangerous for humans than others, what times of day, those kinds of things. But there's a whole bunch of mysteries, you know, sent surrounding the white shark with regard to its basic natural history. You know, in particular, its reproductive biology. You know, where do males and females mate? What's the gestation period? Where do females give birth to their young? Those are super simple questions that we've struggled on a global scale to answer relative to this species and others. So, you know, I think as the tools evolve, we're going to get answers to some of these questions. I just hope I'm still around when that happens.
Yeah, lots to learn. All right, Greg Skomel, Senior Fishery Scientist with the Marine Division of Marine Fisheries. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Mindy. It's great to talk to you.
Coming up after a break, the role of sharks in the marine ecosystem and how a changing ocean could impact these predators. You're listening to The Point on the 50th anniversary of the release of the film Jaws. We're talking sharks this hour. If you have a memory of the film or a question or a comment about white sharks, you can join our conversation at 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Joining us now is Cameron Braun. He's an ocean ecologist and leader of the Woods Hole Oceanographics Marine Predators Group. Welcome.
Hi, good morning, Mindy.
All right, so before we get started, we got to mention this white shark that showed up in Woods Hole over the 4th of July holiday. Of all the places, Stony Beach? I was shocked. I'm sure you must have been too, right?
Yeah, I live right here. I use Stony Beach all the time, and I'm just as surprised as you were.
Yeah, so, and I love that the ladies who were paddleboarding this shark, they only noticed it because they, I guess, were taking a photo, and then they showed it to Greg Skomel, who identified it. But I love they're like, yeah, we're going back in the water. That really was a very rare occurrence, right?
Oh, yeah, super rare. You know, so we just heard Greg talking about, you know, the white sharks on the Outer Cape. And when you think about this area around Woods Hole and Falmouth in particular, you know, we're sort of way off of the highway of migration where the white sharks move from, you know, as he mentioned, sort of the southeast U.S. up through our area here and into Atlantic Canada. It's very rare for them to sort of leave that interstate and come all the way over to us. And so, yeah, they are here, but very rare to see them here.
Yeah, I think one of the ladies who were paddleboarding said, it was lost looking for directions to Chatham.
Yeah, that's exactly how I think about it, too. So, and very cool that they, you know, were, oh, yeah, we're going to go back in the water, no problem. So, you know, that just reflects, I think, some of the changing attitudes around sharks that Greg mentioned.
So we mentioned, Greg talked about the impact the film Jaws had on him when it came out in the 1970s. I think he said he was 13. What kind of impact did the film have on you, if any?
Yeah, you know, I remember seeing it when I was maybe 8 or 10, and I think almost anyone would be lying to themselves if they said they didn't feel some sense of fear in seeing that, right? And so it definitely accomplished that goal, though I realized that wasn't a goal. But, you know, I think it also was inspiring to me. And, you know, Greg kind of captured that, too, with, you know, how it sort of drove him to really study sharks and be interested in them. And similarly for me, it motivated me to study the ocean and try and understand how does all this work.
Yeah. So Huey, and in particular, Huey Marine Superintendent Dick Edwards played a role in making the film, that final scene of the film. Tell us that story.
Yeah, so Dick was a munitions expert in World War II and was here at Huey working in the Marine Operations Group. And Spielberg and his team approached him, and they were looking for someone who could basically blow up a large mechatronic shark. And so, long story short, they took some explosives over, stuffed them into Bruce, the 25 or so foot mechanical shark. And I think my favorite aspect of that is this was like 1974, 1975, yeah. Right? So they didn't have computer graphics to generate all the blood and guts that, mm-hmm. that actually happened in the film. And so they actually stuffed the shark with all these explosives, but also a bunch of raw meat, like from the supermarket, steaks and hamburgers and whatnot, so that in the film you actually see sort of the gory ending. And sorry for the spoiler alert for folks who haven't seen it. But
is there anybody on the planet who has not seen that film yet? I don't think so. Well, I mean, what a great opportunity. I'm sure Dick was like, you want me to blow up? Yes, right?
Yeah, oh, absolutely, yeah. Yep.
All right. So 50 years ago, we didn't know much about white shark biology and behavior. What are some of the things that the film got wrong about white sharks, especially when it comes to their behavior as predators?
Yeah, well, I mean, the whole film is centered around this sort of idea of a man-hunting shark, right? And so I think that's by far and away number one, the thing that I wouldn't say the movie necessarily got it wrong, because I don't think they were trying to necessarily be scientifically accurate. But yes, that is absolutely not the case. And so, you know, Greg mentioned a little bit about the diet of these animals, right? They mostly eat fish, and as they get bigger, they eat, you know, marine mammals like seals. But they're definitely not a, you know, a human hunting animal. That's, we're not really part of their diet. And I think actually probably most bites are them kind of being curious about their environment, right? They don't have hands like we do. They're not touching things in their environment and understanding them in that way. One of their main sensory capabilities is with their mouth, right? And so I think ultimately they end up being a little bit misunderstood in that way. Yeah,
I think that's one thing too. We didn't really, they're curious animals, right? I mean, that's what they're like, what is this? Or they think we're a seal.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Right. Yeah, exactly. You know, and so I think curiosity is maybe one of my favorite aspects when you think about something like a giant predator like a white shark, right? Actually, work by Greg and some other folks at Woods Hole Oceanographic, engineers in particular, they have great footage of, you know, following these sharks with underwater robots, essentially. And for the first time, we were putting cameras in their environment over extended periods of time and actually seeing how curious these animals are, coming up to the robot, checking it out. Folks have probably seen this footage, has been around for several years now, but I think that really opened our eyes to just how curious these animals are. So I think you hit that dead on. Yeah.
And over the past 50 years, what have we learned about the shark's place in the marine ecosystem?
Well, I think we've known that they're sort of at the top of that food pyramid, if you will. I think what's maybe changed in the last 50 years is our understanding of just how important their role really is in sort of that broader ecosystem. So, you know, for a long time, there was this idea of, oh, we need to cull sharks. We need to take this animal out of this ecosystem because, you know, we're trying to catch especially the animals that they eat, like in our fisheries, for example. So if we take away that predator, then, you know, our fisheries will flourish. And it turns out that that's actually not the case. So they play a really important role in kind of keeping the ecosystem balanced, if you will.
Yeah. And we've learned so much, I mean, which helps with some of the misunderstandings about sharks. And I was thinking, I mentioned I was one of those who wouldn't go in the water for a while after watching Jaws. Yeah. And I remember this was in the 1980s, probably early 1980s. I was snorkeling somewhere in the Bahamas, off the Bahamas, with a boyfriend I had at the time, and there was a, I don't know what kind of shark it was, but it looked like a baby shark. I hightailed it right back to that boat, and he's going, what are you doing? I go, I'm getting back in the boat. He's like, why? I'm like, there's a baby shark. He's like, it's a baby shark. I'm like, well, there's a baby, there's a mama.
Yeah.
So it is just like this, I mean, and he stayed in the water, didn't get bit by
baby
shark. Yeah. But it really created a lot of fear. And I think we still see a lot of, you know, fear. But as we're saying, these attacks are really rare.
Oh, yeah, exceedingly rare. And, you know, Greg mentioned this, but, you know, I like to tell people that, you know, it's much more likely that you're struck by lightning than bit by a shark. And you don't really meet people out walking around on the street who are, you know, regularly worried about being struck by lightning. Yeah. So, you know, yes, there are some things you can do to keep safe, as Greg mentioned, you know, stay in relatively shallow water, especially in places where there are a high abundance of sharks. Other than that, you know, I think just, you know, enjoy the water and sort of try to appreciate that we share this place with them, and it's, you know, it's their home too, and we just have to be smart about that.
Right. Yeah. So tell us more about the research and work of the Marine Predators Group at HUI.
Yeah, we do all kinds of sort of oceanography and ocean ecology, including some things on sharks, but we also work on a lot of the other, especially local species we have here in the Cape and Islands, tunas, marlin, all kinds of other really interesting predators. And, you know, we're trying to understand basically how does the ocean work? How do these animals make a living in our waters here? And also, what do they do when they leave, and sort of why do they do that? So Greg talked a little bit about the white sharks in particular. They make these really large-scale migrations all over the western North Atlantic into the Gulf of Mexico. They sort of make these movements that still really impress me. You know, I look at maps of, you know, tracking these animals with these tags all the time, and I've been doing this for quite a while now, and I still am so impressed by just the thousands and thousands of miles that these animals can cover, you know, and just consistently year after year after year. Yeah. Very impressive.
Yeah. It's so interesting to think that humans have a bigger influence on sharks than they have on us. What are the ways humans, even far from the oceans, are impacting sharks?
Well, I think one of the main ones is how you're making seafood choices, right? That's a pretty interesting one. That's not necessarily something I'm a super expert in, but, you know, there's lots of resources out there on how, you know, your seafood choices, for example, impact the other animals in the ocean, including sharks and marine mammals and other things that maybe you wouldn't expect, right? Mm-hmm. So you order a piece of tuna at a restaurant somewhere, and you know, you expect that you're impacting that tuna, and maybe that's about it. But you know, that's not really the case. And so there's many examples where you know, certain animals, certain fish or sharks or whatever are sold under a different label that maybe is confusing to a consumer. So there's this whole ecosystem of kind of resources out there to help you make smart choices. But that's one, you know, really big one. Yeah.
Yeah. We talked about fishing, and there was a time where we had shark tournaments, right? Right on the vineyard we had one. And I know they've had them in Florida, different places. Do we still see that anymore? Or have people stopped doing that?
They are still around, but it's quite rare. Yeah. I think people have really come around to this idea of, you know, appreciating sharks and angling for sharks, right? In many cases, there's not anything wrong with fishing for sharks, just like any other tuna or marlin or mm-hmm. anything else you would fish for. It's more about just appreciating them. There's all kinds of, you know, catch and release strategies to maximize, you know, the health of these animals as you catch them, get them close to your boat, for example, as an angler, appreciate them, right? That's one of my favorite things about the science that we do is in some cases we're catching and tagging sharks like makos and blue sharks right here in our backyard. And I feel very fortunate to have these animals up alongside the boat to put a tag on and get to actually see them, touch them, right?
Up close and personal, yeah.
They're a really amazing animal. And the same is true when you know, you can get in the water with them in sort of a safe situation and really appreciate how curious they are, how beautiful they are in the water. Yeah, really cool animals.
You sort of touched on this, but how might a reduction in the number of the larger sharks, light white sharks, impact the marine ecosystem?
Yeah, for me, I just think about it as a balance, right? So you're sort of tipping the scales in the wrong direction. And some of these large predators are really important for maintaining that balance in the ecosystem. So you can imagine as you push down on one side of that balance, is obviously a balance like this would have many sides. But mm-hmm. if you imagine just a sort of two-sided balance here, you know, as you push down on a population of a large predator, the other side's going to go up, right? And that is often the case, but it usually isn't necessarily a linear transaction, if you will. When you push down on a large predator, some of the species kind of below that in the food chain tend to go up, but in sort of unexpected ways. And that's something we're still working on, trying to figure out, you know, exactly how those impacts kind of cascade and move through an ecosystem and impact the other species there, but it's certainly not a kind of linear impact. Yeah. So it's very complex.
We talk a lot about the white sharks, but what are some of the other sharks that we have in our waters here? And a lot of times people mistake the basking shark for a white shark, and those guys are just, you know, they're not eating man-eating, yeah. right? I mean, they're vegetarians, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they're like a large vacuum cleaner in the ocean, right? Just slowly swimming around, sucking up plankton, so absolutely harmless to us. But another, you know, very large shark that, you know, at a glance could easily be mistaken for a white shark and people might be scared of. I think as you get closer and you see them sort of slowly moving around with their mouth open, sucking up plankton, you should realize pretty quickly that they're more like a giant teddy bear than than some man-eating creature. But yeah, so we have basking sharks. We have, as I mentioned, blue sharks, shortfin mako sharks. We have a lot of smaller kind of coastal sharks like dogfish. And then, you know, we're fortunate here where we have access to the offshore environment as well. So we get a lot of seasonal migrants that come into the warmer waters that end up offshore of us here on the Cape. So we have things like whale sharks that end up coming up this far in the summertime. So we've been working on those for a number of years now. We're really lucky. We have so many sharks and other really incredible species right here in our backyard. So yeah, we're very fortunate.
I'm just thinking, you know, we talk a little about birds and like the change with climate change and different species of birds we're seeing expand territory. I imagine you're seeing the same thing in the ocean.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yep. That's so there's a large element of the research that we do in the Marine Predators Group at Woods Hole, which is trying to understand those changes and especially trying to predict them. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for example, Greg mentioned this sort of public safety aspect of understanding how white sharks use habitat around the Cape and Islands. Well, you can imagine if we can forecast the weather reasonably well, could we also start to forecast things like where these animals are, when they're there, white sharks, but other animals too? And how can we use that to our advantage to, for example, enhance public safety? So we're building a lot of models that basically help us understand how these changes are occurring, when and where they're occurring, and also can we predict them? And I think that's one of the most important things that we're doing right now in this space is, can we predict how these changes are impacting these animals and maybe sort of get ahead of some of those changes and be proactive about them?
As we were talking with Greg, we've learned so much, but there's still so much we don't know.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
Yeah. You'll have a job for a while.
Yeah, plenty of job security when it comes to wide open questions in ocean science.
866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Cameron Braun, ocean ecologist and leader of the Woods Hole Oceanographic Marine Predators Group. 866-999-4626 is our number. If you'd like to join our conversation, story or a comment or question, 866-999-4626, our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. For a long time, we thought the deepest part of the oceans were devoid of life. But your research has shown that the twilight zone of the ocean is integral to the top marine predators. Tell us about that. And for folks who don't know what the twilight zone is, tell us that too.
Yeah. So the twilight zone is this kind of deep part of the ocean where light starts to fade. And you can imagine sort of a twilight-like environment where there's some light, but very little. And a lot of animals are uniquely adapted to use that environment. As we think of like prey species for some of these predators, live there pretty much all the time, and so they're well adapted to do that. One of the things that we study is how predators use that environment. So it's a very remote and very challenging part of the ocean to study. Mm-hmm. So we still have a lot of even very basic questions that are wide open, including how many fish are there, how many squid are there. That's estimates range orders of magnitude still, and so that's a huge challenge for us. But we do know that, you know, we put tags on some of these predators and they spend time at those depths in the ocean. So we're talking, you know, 600 feet down to well over 1,000. And Greg mentioned some of these white sharks are diving to, you know, well over 1,000 feet as well. And in some cases, you know, 3,000-4,000 feet. Mm. So this is a really mysterious, kind of enigmatic part of the ocean. And it turns out that, you know, every one of these marine predators pretty much that we put a tag on that can tell us about how these animals are using depth in the ocean, they pretty much all go there. And so it's really interesting. I kind of think of it as potentially this like deep ocean buffet, you know, that's sort of set out there, but it's dark, it's cold, the pressure's high, and it's hard for these animals to spend a lot of time there that are kind of used to the surface ocean where it's much warmer, there's light, et cetera. So yeah, it's a very challenging place to study, but a really interesting.
Yeah, you mentioned it. So it's remote, inhospitable. How do you use a lot of robotics?
So that's one of the advantages of being at Woods Hole Oceanographic is, you know, we have access to a lot of these sort of robotic platforms. Greg mentioned some of these great tag technologies that have come online, you know, in sort of his career as a shark scientist. And so, you know, we now have a lot of really great robotic tools, platforms, but also tags that we can put on these animals that help us sort of spy on them as they move, you know, thousands of miles through the ocean over days to weeks to even months.
Yeah. I talked to Meg, who's giving us a call from Harwich. Hi, Meg.
Hi. I want to thank you for all your hard work. And I was told when I went down by the Nature Conservancy, which is fabulous work, that everybody should have a stop the bleed kit when they go to the beach. Everybody should have a stop the bleed kit when they go to the beach, and when they go in the water they shouldn't splash and they shouldn't wear shiny jewelry. And they should not go basically past, you know, a little bit past their knees.
Well, what do you think about that? What about the shiny jewelry? That will attract like some fish, right?
Yeah. I think shiny jewelry is a really good one, especially for some of the fish and smaller sharks. You know, a lot of the smaller sharks that are in near the beach are, you know, targeting small shiny fish as prey. Mm-hmm. And so absolutely you can imagine a scenario, especially in, you know, murky water where a small shark might mistake that shiny jewelry for prey and sort of try and take a bite at it.
Yeah. What about the stop the bleed kit? A lot of the lifeguards, I mean, some of the beaches have that.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. A lot of the beaches have those capabilities. It's certainly not a bad idea.
Yeah.
And, you're swimming at beaches that don't have lifeguards, maybe that makes it an even better idea. Again, you know, getting bit by a shark is a very, very unlikely scenario, but there's absolutely no harm in sort of being prepared
being
in that
prepared
way, Meg.
The...
Yeah. That's
yeah.
Great.
Meg, thank you for the call. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. As an ocean ecologist, you're looking at both biological, physical, and chemical oceanography. What are we learning about ocean currents and circulation that helps us better understand ocean predators like sharks?
That's a really interesting question, because for a long time, we weren't really able to kind of resolve how these animals use currents, especially in sort of fine scales. And we're recently starting to understand, especially through fishery partners, for example, just how complex those relationships are between how these animals use and especially move around in the ocean and how their environment itself is moving. You know, mm-hmm. So we imagine, you know, we have gravity, we're walking around, our environment is relatively static. It doesn't move under our feet, let's put it that way. But if you imagine being one of these large sharks, you're out in this relatively featureless, it seems, ocean where, you know, everywhere you look is just blue water, presumably. Mm-hmm. And so they've evolved to have lots of really interesting capabilities to sense, you know, where they are and also maybe where they want to go and how to go there. So, a good example is using the deep ocean. These animals have, incredible abilities to kind of see in the dark or sense their prey in the dark, even if they can't see in those low light conditions. So, I mean, yeah, we could go on and on about, you know, this, how interesting it is that how these animals make a living in this place. Yeah.
So how does ocean chemistry, particularly changes in ocean chemistry, impact sharks?
Yeah, when I think about changes to the ocean, I think about it a little more holistically than just chemistry. Oh, that's a really good question. We know things like pH, like the acidity of the ocean, impacts especially things that build shells.
Mm-hmm.
And as we mentioned, this is a complex ecosystem where everything is sort of linked, right? So I try and think about, as you mentioned, Mindy, the biology, the chemistry, and the physics all sort of tied into one. And some of the recent work we've been working on on predators specifically in our part of the ocean suggests that a lot of these animals are going to redistribute with some of these expected changes to the ocean, whether it's the warming temperatures, as Greg mentioned, white sharks in particular seem tied to some of these temperature changes. But along with the temperature change, which is what most people talk about, you get all kinds of other changes too that are predicted, including changes to the chemistry of the ocean. So what we expect right now, this is sort of our like best guess, if you will, as a community of scientists, is that a lot of these animals are going to redistribute, and some of them, in some cases, already have started sort of changing their home range, if you want mm-hmm. to think about it that way.
Yeah. Yeah. And temperature, as we know, plays a big role, at least with the white sharks, right?
Yeah, so temperature, I would argue, plays a big role with almost all of these marine animals. White sharks are a little bit better able to live in cold water, also in warm tropical water and kind of everything in between. There are costs associated with that, obviously, but there's this big, highly mobile animal that can kind of warm their body above ambient water temperature if they need to. And so they're, I would say, relatively buffered from at least some of the small scale or fine scale temperature changes.
Yeah. And then, you think about, as we were talking about climate change and some of the ocean life that we're seeing that maybe we didn't see so much before, or, that they come in the summer and then get stuck here. I mean, like we think of like the turtles for one, but there are other ocean creatures, right, that maybe haven't been in this range that get here now. Do they, I know it's a big ocean, so you don't really know if they all get out, but
right?
Do
yeah.
they migrate back?
Some of them
get
do.
Stuck
some
here?
Of them don't.
Yeah.
It's a really good question. I think one of the best examples of this sort of slow, long-term march of a change in our oceans is something like the black sea bass, right? I think a lot of people in our community fish for them, and they haven't always been able to do that. And now we have them in large numbers here locally on the Cape and Islands. So that's a kind of an example of this animal that has moved in from the south and is now seem sort of set up shop here.
I was gonna say, and there's always the flip side too, like lobsters moving a little farther north, right?
Yep. No, exactly. And for those of us who have spent time, you know, snorkeling around in the waters of the Cayman Islands, have seen tropical fish in the summertime,
yeah.
right? It's just one of these
That's
things
I mean,
you're alluding
yeah.
to. And it's unlikely that, you know, a small little butterfly fish or something, one of these coral reef-like animals makes it out of here by the time, you know, when things cool down. But, you know, the Gulf Stream is sort of moving a lot of water toward us all the time. And I think that's got something to do with, you know, how these animals that are tropical move into our waters. Yeah.
As Greg mentioned earlier, people's fascination with sharks can be positive because it provides an opportunity to educate, right? So now 50 years later with Jaws, we use that film more as an education tool in some ways, right?
Yeah, so, yes.
Yeah. So what are some of the ways who we can help combat the misconception and also foster an appreciation of sharks?
Yeah, that's one of the things that I've just been so pleasantly surprised about, especially this summer with the celebration of the 50th anniversary of Jaws, is just how much appreciation people seem to have for these animals these days. And Greg sort of mentioned this evolution in the perception of these animals by especially our local community. And before we came on, you and I were talking about sort of the ecotourism around
right.
white sharks in the Cape and Islands.
Who
would have thought? Exactly. Yeah. And so I find some comfort, some inspiration in this idea that, you know, we as a community are starting to embrace these animals being here and sort of sharing these places with them. And as Greg mentioned, you know, there's a lot of really good educational resources out there at Woods Hole Oceanographic, at the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy and other places, you know, about how we can do better to sort of appreciate these animals, appreciate the ocean and sort of share these places with these really cool animals. Yeah.
Denise and Orlean says, it seems like the activity on the Sharktivity app is down this year compared to previous years. Is this so? And what might explain the reasons? I'm wondering if it's, as Greg said, they're just not here yet, most of them, right?
Yeah. Greg would be better to answer that, but absolutely most of the white sharks are just not here yet this season. And so I don't know maybe if she's talking about she saw more activity like at this time last year than this year. You know, the ocean is a very dynamic place. And as we mentioned, white sharks are tied to environmental cues like temperature. And so if it was a little bit warmer last year, for example, the sharks might have showed up a little bit earlier. A lot of animals in the ocean really do kind of migrate based on things like temperature. And so, yeah, that fluctuates year on year. And as I was mentioning before, if we could start to actually predict these changes, even with, you know, a few weeks or a few months notice, that might really help us, you know, sort of calibrate, okay, when are the sharks coming? When do we really need to start being, you know, extra careful at the beaches and those kinds of things?
Yeah. Greg spends a good part of the summer and fall getting up close and personal with white sharks as part of the tagging program. Does your work ever get you in close proximity to sharks? And if so, what have been some of those experiences?
Yeah, we do a lot of local field work here in the summer as well. You know, so Greg does a lot of the coastal work, especially on white sharks. Right now, most of our projects are on some of these offshore species I mentioned. So we're going offshore working on things like whale sharks. And we also have blue marlin and white marlin here in the summer. So those are kind of our three main species that we're working on this summer. And yeah, for those of you who haven't spent time in the water with a large shark, even one like a whale shark or something that's totally harmless, I highly recommend finding a place to do that and going and checking it out. I can still remember the first time I jumped in the water with a, you know, 30-foot-long whale shark, and you know, it took my breath away. I was just so inspired and sort of awestruck by the beauty of these animals. So highly recommend.
Have you ever gotten to go down in the cage with the sharks or no?
I have not. No, I haven't.
Would you?
Been in a cage.
Would you like to?
I would. I think I would actually rather get in the water with a big white shark without a cage in a place where maybe you can see fairly well and, you know, and sort of be kind of unobstructed by the cage. But yeah, if a cage was necessary to make that happen, I would absolutely do it.
I don't know if you know the answer to this question, but, you know, people have different personalities. There can be aggressive people and passive people. And are sharks like that?
You know, there's some evidence that a lot of animals have these sort of personalities or this individual variability. So for sure, there's individual variability in, for example, how these animals move around in the ocean. No question. We have a hard time making long-term observations on how these animals move and on their behavior. So I would say it's mostly an open question in the ocean. There's definitely more evidence for animals on land, just I think because we can observe them and study them a little bit easier. So the short answer is yes. I think there is individual variability and almost personalities, if we want to anthropomorphize them a little bit, certainly on land in some animals. And I would imagine that's probably the case for some marine species as well.
And now the sharks, we give them names, right? And
yeah.
The people names. Do they also have, like, you know, the scientific numbers as well? Or is it we just go by the
names?
Yeah,
no. I think every scientist I know, and including our group, gives them also, you know, some sort of scientific ID number associated with it. It's a little easier to track, you know, just a specific number than it is a whole bunch of names of tagged animals. Yeah.
Kind of fun, though, if you've got a shark named after you and you can follow that one on the Sharktivity
app. Oh, no question.
App, right?
It's tons of fun. Yeah. No, I think that's great.
It's almost like, I don't know, maybe they do this with the sharks, but you know, you get the bracelets that have the sea turtle or, you know, whatever other animal, and you get to follow it online.
Yeah, that's something that people do with sharks as well.
Oh, they do.
Absolutely.
All right, so what about giant squid? You know, everybody says you never see a giant squid. I'm just thinking with all of this, you know, now getting to get deeper in water and in the twilight zone, has anybody seen one? Alive?
Yeah. I mean, there's been very few observations, but I think this goes back to this idea of just how mysterious the deep ocean really is. So, yeah, you mentioned we have more capability to make observations in the deep ocean now. We have submersibles, we have all kinds of robotics, and that's opening our eyes to sort of how the deep ocean works. But if you can imagine, you know, going down, let's say, in a submersible, for example, into the deep ocean, that is one tiny little snapshot in what I can't even, as an ocean ecologist, fathom the size of the ocean just in space, just how much of the Earth it covers. And nevertheless, think about, okay, well, now it's actually three-dimensional, and it has depth, and it goes super deep in some places, you know, 11,000 meters or more, right? So it's just an unfathomably large volume of habitat for these animals, and yet we're still at the level where we're just taking these teeny tiny little snapshots of the deep ocean. And so I think there's a heck of a lot for us to still discover. And I think that's one of the main reasons why I'm so excited to be doing what I do, is because it's such a mysterious place. It's sort of this last frontier on Earth that we're still, in 2025, exploring.
Yeah, it's amazing. And then when you do find something, wow. I'm just thinking, like, all of the science around the hydrothermal vents, which we thought had no life. And lo and behold.
Yeah, it turns out animals have figured out how to make energy out of chemical bonds, right?
Yeah.
Which, like, we always thought it was all based on the sun. So it's a perfect example, Mindy, of exactly how, you know, life sort of finds a way, even in the deepest, darkest reaches of the ocean.
Yeah. So what have been some of the surprises that you've come across in your explorations there? And whether it's the Twilight Zone or somewhere else, you know, you come across something you didn't expect.
I think for me, the biggest surprise so far has been just how consistently and reliably the predators that we study use the deep ocean. And to me, that it seems like such an inhospitable environment. And yet, kind of no matter where you look, you see these predators using that habitat. And maybe what's most surprising is that, you know, they've all evolved to do it in a slightly different way. So you have, you know, enormous sperm whales that are holding their breath, literally, and diving down to eat some of these really large squids at, you know, 5,000 feet or even deeper on a breath hold, right?
Yeah.
And then on the other end of the spectrum, you have things like white sharks that obviously can breathe in the water, but they're dealing with things like temperature, right? It's very cold at depth, so they have to deal with that. It's very dark, and so they have to be able to see or have some other way of detecting their prey. So, you know, everywhere you look, there are these animals that have evolved really interesting and creative, if you will, ways to use these deep ocean habitats.
In a lot of ways, I'm just thinking, you are so lucky. You get to sort of explore in this magical world.
Yeah. Oh, it's like a fairy tale. Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, and you start to look at some of the deep ocean creatures, and I think that becomes quite obvious, right? Things that glow, growing out of fish's heads, and all kinds of crazy stuff. But this is real life. It's a real life mystery, and it's fun to sort of be one of those detectives.
Yeah. Just got about a minute left, so just to kind of recap on what people should keep in mind with submission: don't swim way out where there's seals, right? So tell us some things we need to just keep in mind.
Yeah, I think some of the things we've heard about are all really good bits of advice. So, you know, stay in water sort of shallower than waist deep, especially if you're in a place like the Outer Cape or other places where there are a lot of sharks. I think Meg mentioned the shiny jewelry thing, especially coastally where you have a lot of small sharks in places like Florida. That's a really great guideline. And and otherwise, you know, just appreciate that anywhere you swim, there might be a shark. And so just, you know, stay shallow, stay sort of in your comfort zone. And if you do see one, you know, give it space, be calm, get out of the water, and go on and enjoy your day.
Yeah. Right. Cameron Brown is an ocean ecologist and leader of the Woods Hole Oceanographics Marine Predators Group, who he has a discovery center in Woods Hole where you can learn more about the sharks and other marine predators. We'll post a link with more information at our website, capeandislands.org. Thanks for being here and sharing your work.
Thanks, Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.